Hi, you're listening to Record of Change. My name is Stephanie Rabel, and I'm your host for this episode. Record of Change features the stories of individuals from across the world about how their lives are being shaped by the COVID-19 pandemic. We listen to our interviewees at several points in time because we want to follow their stories of how their lives are changing. This season, we will feature a mixture of some new and familiar voices and stories. I'm speaking to you from Delaware in the United States, where our most vulnerable populations have just started getting the vaccine this month. Today, we'll listen to the story of Aaron Levine, a comedian in London, England, at a time when the more contagious COVID-19 variant is spreading, but thankfully the vaccine is in its first few weeks of rolling out. This is our first interview with Aaron, and in this episode, he shares a bit about his personal experience of being a newlywed comic, during a time when he was feeling like his career was just gaining some traction. He knows he's lucky not to be in the same position as many comedians, and he talks about the new modes of comedy and how they lack that personal connection he seeks. Aaron and I have never met before, but we have a loved one in common, his wife Stephanie. So today I get to hear a bit about Aaron and his life and how they're surviving this COVID experience. Aaron, thank you for being here today.
Sure, no worries. Got nothing else to do.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself just generally before we hear a little bit about your corona time story?
Sure. I'm 46 years old. I have degrees in television production and theatre acting, two separate degrees, and a minor in English Lit as well. So I studied in Pace University in New York for one of my degrees and my television production degree in England. And before finding comedy, I was convinced I was going to be a movie director. So right from the age of 12 or 10, I watched lots of very artsy films. I went to all the art house cinemas, worked as a production assistant for years, but lacked the social skills because I'm a comedian to work my way up. There were all these people that started off making cups of tea and ended up directing films that I started off at the same time as, and I just made cups of tea for about 10 years. So that wasn't really working for me. I'm an executive producer of Judy, which is the film about Judy Garland. I forgot about that. I did actually get somewhere, but I mean, that was only because I inherited some money when my parents died. And my uncle's a movie producer. He produced a ton of films in the 80s. He produced a bunch of theatre and that sort of thing as well, quite successfully. He's a cool dude, my uncle. And he asked me to put some money into the film Judy, about Judy Garland, while it was being developed maybe 8 years ago, just when I'd inherited. And I got an executive producer's credit on it at the end, which, given the overall budget was in the millions, I gave a very small percentage. Anyway, I spent a lot of time. I wanted to learn how to direct people. I better learn how actors work, I thought. When I was at Pace in New York, I started doing some acting classes, and then I got hooked because, like all performers, I had an unnurturing mother and, you know, wanted to get attention from strangers. So I just got hooked on it. I'd never had any attention. Yeah. So I was like, oh, man, this is my life now. I'm one of those actor types. I looked down on actors before that. I thought, oh, you know, they're a bunch of poncy, emotionally unstable. And they are, but I am too, apparently. So...
So having such a creative family and coming from that background, how did you find comedy?
I mean, I played Caliban in The Tempest, and that was at uni, it took me 3 or 4 years to work up my way up to the higher roles, the better roles at uni. And I found that I liked making people laugh, and I became part of a comedy group at uni. And I hated the emotional rollercoaster of the more serious roles. You have to really experience all the big emotions, and I didn't like it very much. I just wanted to make people laugh. So when I got home, I have a friend called Josh Howie. He's been a headliner at the Comedy Store, and he's been going for 10 years and all that stuff. And I was like, dude, I need to get into comedy. And he was like, well, do a course. And he was like, your life story is interesting enough that you've got source material. And I did a course, and 6 years later, I'm still doing it. So I've got ADD. I've got a typical ADD CV. I mean, if I had to get a real job, I'd find it difficult. Let's put it that way. Because my dad although I was wealthy, he wanted me to look after myself and learn how to, so I had to have a proper job and all that sort of thing.
As someone who listens to a lot of comedy, I've been hearing from comedians, obviously, that this 2020 time and what happened with the coronavirus has been very, very disruptive to the industry. Bring yourself back to February or March, where this was just starting. What were some of your thoughts?
It made me anxious, obviously, and it made Steph anxious, my wife. We're both larger. And at the time, I was even larger than I am now. I was 32 pounds heavier at the beginning of lockdown than I am now.
You went the opposite of most of us.
Yes. I sort of went from about 260, 270 pounds to 230, something like 240. So I'm still big, but I was much bigger. And so I was worried about, you know, because straight away they were like, it's going to get you if you're fat. So I was worried about that. And I was doing gigs, and then I started taking only pay gigs. Before, I was doing only the free gigs just for experience and stuff like that. And I was like, if it's paid and it might progress my career, I'll take it. So I cut back my gigs straight away. But even then, it was risky. I basically worked right up until that first day of lockdown in the United Kingdom. I did a gig the night before. It was in March. And in the UK, the comedy circuit works. You drive all over. I would drive up to 4 hours each way. So an 8 hour round trip to do 10 to 20 minutes of stage time. But I was in a room full of people, and obviously there were quite a lot of nervous jokes at the time about, oh, we've all got COVID now, and maybe I should be wiping the microphone down and that sort of thing. And yeah, it was anxiety making.
At the time, in the back of your mind, how long did you think that this was going to impact what you were doing?
I've got the Google Assistant downstairs. So I said, Google, set reminder for 3 months' time. And 3 months later, this alarm went off and said, you have been in lockdown for 3 months. It should be over now. Hooray. It wasn't over. So I thought 3 months, apparently. I don't really remember setting that, but it came off. You have survived lockdown. And I hadn't.
When did it dawn on you that it was going to be a little bit longer than that 3 months than you had initially thought?
In the UK, we've got the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And that, you plan for that. It's the highlight of your year because you get a lot of stage time and you run your own shows. I was going to run two shows. I was going to run my own show plus a mixed bill. I'm Jewish. I was going to do a Jewish-themed comedian mixed bill called Jewarama, where we've got different Jews on. But I was always getting stage time. I was on for 10 or 20 minutes each hour. And then I was going to run my own show, which would have been my own hour about inheriting money, because I inherited money, and that's kind of unique. I called it birthright. That was it. Because I inherited neurosis and money and, you know, the payoff. Both my parents died. My mum died when I was 19. My dad died when I was about 30. And then, you know, they both died of cancer and I've had cancer. So I sort of inherited cancer. No, my aunt died of cancer. My grandparents died of cancer. My cat had cancer. So that's what the show was about. So I was going to do an hour on that. And yeah, but like I said, I would drive 12 or 13,000 miles a year to get stage time. Edinburgh for a month in August, you just get a couple of hours of stage time a day because you're doing guest spots at other people's shows as well all the time. But that, you start booking for that. You book your accommodation 8 months in advance. You apply to organisations with your show in January, really. So once I started cancelling that in the summer, I realised it wasn't going to happen because they were going to cancel it, and they did.
I'm imagining that during this time, it's been hard to do the traditional forms of comedy. What has kept you sane? What do you do for fun during this time? Have you picked up any new hobbies?
Yeah, there's lots going on. There are online gigs that I do. There's particular promoters that really like me and ask me to come on and do online gigs. I don't get paid for them, but it keeps me sane. And it also helps me write material and that sort of thing. There's Zoom gigs. So like this, but I put it in gallery view. So it's like Brady Bunch, so I can see all the audience. There's only ever like 20, 30 little squares that I can see, you know, on a couple of different pages of people. And he makes them put all their cameras and mics on so you can get feedback, which is also, it's weird because you've got lots of people laughing and the timing's weird and everything's strange. But it's a lot of fun.
I wish my students would do that. I've asked them to turn on their videos. And one time I had one student for weeks just have her camera on and then no one else did.
That's like a film, Real Genius, where they start sending their tape decks to the lecture hall to record the teacher. And eventually the teacher sends a tape deck. Do you remember that?
It's like, I've never seen the film, but that is exactly what it feels like. I feel like sometimes I'm like a podcast that they don't want to listen to.
Yeah.
Oh, but I'm sure that seeing those visuals sometimes helps to feel like at least there are real people there.
It really helps, because I did other gigs as well where I couldn't see people, and you're just hoping there's an audience out there. And it's so weird. You're just doing jokes, especially when you're writing new stuff. I got married in July last year, and I kind of exaggerate it for the comedy, and I say basically I'm a newlywed, and this lockdown is my honeymoon. It sped up the marriage process. I'm getting divorced in 2 weeks, I say. You know, when I'm trying out stuff like that, I don't know if people are going to laugh. I've taken courses in, I did a Steve Martin online comedy course for the masterclass, and now I'm trying to write kids' books because I have random ideas about kids' stories, and a couple of people have told me I should, but I have no idea how to write kids' books, so I started taking an online course for that as well. I've got an idea about counting sheep. You know, when you sleep, you count sheep.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the sheep, my sheep, Ralph, is purple and belches rainbows and wakes everyone up. And he just wants to fit in. But there's a whole load of new things to learn about that. You've got to have an inciting incident, and you've got to have antagonists, and you've got to have conflict. And I was like, should I make it a murder mystery? Maybe that's not good for kids. Anyway, there's that. And I've learned to cook. We've been cooking it a lot. We've been using these boxes where you get all the ingredients in a box, and the recipes are really simple, and it's all weighed out for you, and you just follow it. From that, we've gotten confidence, and we're really learning to cook now. We bought a crock pot and we're slow cooking it. And yeah, I did lose weight. I lost weight because all the restaurants shut down in the first lockdown. They're open now initially, but also because I was worried that being fat would kill me. So it was highly motivational to lose weight, because I thought there was less of a chance if I was less heavy that COVID would kill me, basically.
What has it been like to be in this lockdown environment where you're a newlywed without kids and trying to reconnect to things? How has this experience been for you guys?
I enjoyed it at first. I'm like a lot of comedians. A lot of people are surprised to find that comedians are introverts. I don't know why, but I certainly am, and I hate people. It's not that. I just find it draining to be at a party and be outgoing and all that sort of thing. And I like spending alone time. So initially it was good, but even I like need family, at least my close family. So it was, yeah, difficult. I mean, we're lucky in that my sister lives about a mile away. So during the initial lockdown, we would walk over there and do doorsteps. We'd stand at the end of the driveway wearing masks, and we'd see, I have a niece and nephew. Those are our substitute children as well. And we just give them back afterwards. Except we don't even get to give them back because we can't touch them now. Uncle Lawrence, I told you about, he just doesn't care. He's 85, and he was like insisting we eat in badly air-conditioned restaurants and things. He's just like, I'm 85, who cares?
Yeah, when I go, I go.
My brother. Yeah, exactly. When I go, you know. It's weird. I mean, I spent a lot of time on the road, and it was strange. It was weird being... I think I've become institutionalised now. So I probably go out every 4 or 5 days, and I feel like I'm in the Shawshank Redemption. Like, I don't like the outside world anymore. I find it frightening, and people are going to cough on me, and do they have COVID, and all that sort of thing. And it's going to take some getting used to when it all ends.
Everybody across the world has been looking into the situation in the UK, especially because I think I heard the other day that the new variant is now the dominant variant that they're finding in
the UK. It's crazy. 1 in 30 people in the town I live in, London, have COVID. 1 in 30. I mean, being independently wealthy, it's a very first world problem, but I've had to get rid of the cleaner. I have got another joke about that, because I've been doing everything on Zoom. I've been doing training on Zoom. I've got a gym 3 times a week, and I've got a yoga mat downstairs, and the guy just, at one point, he was doing it from a pool, like in Luxembourg. He was like lifting his martini up to his lips and going, okay, do 10 star jumps. And each time I did one, he took a swig.
Is this a live Zoom, I'm assuming?
Zoom, yeah. I do a live Zoom stream with him, and he tells me to jump up and down, basically. And I had a joke about my cleaner. Even my cleaner works on Zoom. She calls me up and says, now you take the sponge.
It could work.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, everything's on Zoom now.
Have you found writing comedy, still engaging in comedy, to be somewhat therapeutic? Sometimes comedians feel like that's their way to connect with people. But for you personally, has there been any kind of self-therapy through doing things like comedy or writing?
Well, not really, because there isn't any comedy. All the gigs have stopped. I mean, that's what I really should have said at the beginning of this. So basically, all the pubs no one wants to go to comedy. No one wants to sit in a group of people, even when they could. There was social distancing comedy for a while. You'd have like 1/3 full audiences, but that shut down again, where everyone sat 2 meters apart. But I mean, comedy need a lot of people in an intimate environment. That's how it works. It doesn't work. For a while, there was drive-through comedy. People were doing it in car parks and people were sitting in their cars. It's awful. I was just like, I'm not risking it. I'm not risking the travel. So there was no way for me to connect, really, other than the Zoom gigs. And even that, you know, mostly that's comedians and friends of comedians looking, and the odd fan through a Facebook page, but it's rare. So there's no real way for me to get out there. When I was on the road, I was doing gigs in front of steel mill workers or all kinds of different people all over, you know, posh people in the English countryside who hunt foxes. And that was fun. And that's a way for me to reflect myself back at different and see how I can get different people to laugh. Because within England is so weird. There's different accents 20 miles apart and different cultures. And it's little but massively varied. That's half the fun. But I haven't had any of that. That drove me in a way, that connection with people. And I've lost it. And I've done some writing, but not as much as I should have. But lots of things have been happening. My brother had a heart attack. He's fine, but I've written a bit about that. He got a new puppy a week before he had a heart attack, and his wife was doing a major murder trial. She was on jury service, and they couldn't restart. It would cost them, taxpayer, hundreds of millions of pounds to restart the trial. She couldn't quit. And so he was by himself once he was back home. So I went there with Stephanie, basically went on puppy duty, and he's a fitness fanatic. He's not fat like me. He's a cold water swimmer. It's genetic and apart from anything else. And I was given the job of making sure he didn't do any exercise. He was supposed to stay still. So I like made his cups of tea and whatever and played with the puppy. I did it for a couple of weeks, but I was a convalescence coach. So I was the opposite of my coach. So I wrote a whole bunch of jokes about that. You know, I'm like the perfect person to train someone to be a couch potato. Things are always happening that inspire your comedy. But I don't really know if any of that stuff works because I haven't had a chance to gig. I'm really looking forward to the vaccine being out and getting back on the road and connecting with people. And I really miss that. And I'm really lucky. I did inherit money and I've got enough in the bank where I don't need to make a living. I'd be so screwed if I had to make a living. But there's a lot of comedians out there who they actually made a living from it. You know, I made maybe £400 a month, which is not a living, but people who are doing better than me or sort of semi-professional, you know, who made a living. A lot of my friends, like proper full-on comedians, and they just lost their living like that. They've relied on charity and the government and handouts from the government and that sort of thing. It's the ones who actually declared their taxes who are doing better because they can prove to the government that they've been paid. But it's not really fair to proper comedians who do this for a living.
In the absence of having the normalcy of gigs, have you guys thought about leaving the city?
Well, it was a possibility for a while. There was an option to leave the city, but the place we could have moved to, the internet wouldn't have been good enough for Steph to work remotely. And it was a project that I finally got fixed. We finally got high-speed internet about a month ago up there. No, for various reasons. Internet and also the government was advising against it. They didn't want you to go to a second home or they didn't want you to spread it around the country. They were saying, stay at home. And if you've got nosy neighbours, they'll report, you know, they're all those Londoners are up. You know, there was no way of getting out of the city. Steph has to work remotely and needs a very good internet connection to do it.
Now that we're in 2021, we're in a spot where there's a vaccine that is pending for a lot of us. What are your thoughts and hopes for the coming months?
Well, I'm hoping that gigs will start happening again. I don't know if people are going to be scarred from the idea of going to gigs. They're not going to be used to sitting in rooms close to people. I mean, one of the frustrating things is, I mean, I'm a Jewish hypochondriac. One of the frustrating things is the vaccine is 90% effective. So in the back of your mind, and maybe there'll be that with other people. What if it's the 10%? My uncle, because he is 85, has now had both vaccines. He's had both shots. But I'm still like hesitant to go and see him because what if I'm the 10%, they're 90% effective? Mm-hmm. What if I kill my uncle? I don't want to kill my uncle, you know. What if I spread it somehow? So that could affect gigs. I don't know how it's going to work. It's going to be a weird world. Everyone's going to be joking about the pandemic when the gigs do start again. So I think it's going to be okay as long as you stick to your personal story. For example, I do a lot of jokes about cancer, but that's because I've had a lot of cancer in my family and I've had cancer and I lost my balls and all that. So I do a lot of cancer jokes. So apart from one time where I didn't get the tone right and one woman went around out the room crying, most people laugh, generally, 99% of the time.
What was the moment that that woman went out? Maybe it just hit too close to home?
I think she'd had a family member die of cancer too recently, and I was being a bit flippant, I think, with my material, probably. I don't remember, it was a while ago, but it stuck in my head, and I've actually softened it a bit since then. I think I used to have a throwaway joke about, I used to say, my aunt died of cancer, my grandparents died of cancer, both my parents died of cancer, my cat had cancer, I've had cancer. We shouldn't have had that timeshare in Chernobyl. I think that's what triggered it. But it's just a silly, flippant joke. It's a bit of a shock reaction joke. I've actually dropped that joke from my set now.
You've said a few times that you're thinking a lot of people will be apprehensive. Can you say what it's like to live in London during a time like this? Are there a lot of people that you feel like are more like you that are cautious? Can you tell us a little bit about what the feeling's like there in the city?
Yeah, there's a lot less, from what I can tell, there's a lot less crazy in England than there is in America. There's a lot less conspiracy theory and thing. I don't think there's too much of that in London. There's mostly, when it first started, people were like, it doesn't affect me. There was a bit of that. So in March, there was like, oh, it's not about me. But now everyone, like, the streets are quiet and everyone's wearing masks in supermarkets, more or less. People are being pretty good. Everything's very quiet. It's quiet. Everything. Well, I miss going to the cinema. I miss hanging out with friends. You know, all the normal COVID things that have affected everyone around the world. All the things that you used to do socially. Now we're binge watching Netflix. I've gotten very into computer games. And actually Animal Crossing New Horizons, which was really helpful. I spent 3 months obsessively playing it when the first lockdown happened. But it was like perfect escapism, sort of Zelda type, total escape. There have been coping mechanisms, but then I'm like, what am I contributing to society? You know, I contribute to society by providing escapism, by making people laugh, maybe being a bit edgy, making people a bit uncomfortable. But laughter is a release. Laughter is a release of tension. Right. So you build up the tension with the setup and then you release the tension with the punchline. I'm a Buddhist Jew. I'm a Buju, as I say. And I became a Buddhist Jew when I was in New York. I always say Buddhism is the antidote to Judaism because Judaism's kind of highly neurotic, high strung. We are the chosen people. You've got the immigrant culture. You've got to succeed. You've got to be a doctor or a lawyer. And Buddhism's all like, chill out, be in the moment. Be nice to people, chill out, basically. And it's sort of the antidote. Comedy is a bit like that. Comedy is a bit like, relax, you laugh at it, let go. Comedy is all about letting go. I feel that's, if I can make people let go about things that they wouldn't have let go about, just laugh at things they wouldn't normally laugh at, let go. But I can't do that. In the last 2 weeks, I've signed up to a yoga class, 2 different children's books writing classes, and voice. Nancy Cartwright teaches the lady from Simpsons. She does a masterclass in voice acting. Because I'm like, how am I going to connect with people? I've got to find another way of expressing myself and helping. That's the only way I exist, you know, that I have meaning. Because otherwise, I'm just a bum sitting at home, frankly, living off his dad's money, wasting away. I've got to find a way of being useful to society, you know. The lockdown is intense. I used to just be able to go out and joke, and that's what I did, and I can't anymore.
When we look at the UK news, Brexit is making some progress. Has that been getting in front of people? Is that something?
Yeah, Brexit's there, but it's not such a big deal. It's been going on such a long time. You can't joke about Brexit anymore because it's been done to death. It's been happening 3 or 4 years. And for 3 or 4 years, every couple of times a week, it's been a headline. This is happening in Brexit. That's happening. And no one cares. They've just become numb and immune to it. No one cares anymore. So I think even if COVID wasn't around, we're just like, just get it over with already. And I think there's a sense of relief coming that it's done with, more or less. We've left. I don't think people really care anymore.
Are there any jokes that have aged out? So you alluded to the fact that Brexit had its window where you could joke about it and then it's kind of over. Is there anything that you feel like in this moment in time, are COVID jokes over? Or when will we get there?
They haven't even... I don't know, because I haven't been out there. I suspect you're going to have to be careful about it, because there are people who have died from it. I know people that have been in intensive care, and even I've been affected by it as well. I think you'll find out when the gigs start happening. On the online gigs, people haven't been really joking about COVID per se. They've been joking about lockdown, about how it affects them. But I haven't seen any sort of harsh COVID jokes. I don't think people would do that. It's a very politically correct world at the moment. You have to be pretty careful. There's a saying in comedy, always punch up, don't punch down. And I think that's fair. And what that means is, don't make jokes about homeless people. Don't make it punch up, punch towards the politicians. Being a white middle-class male, there's not a lot of people above me to punch towards, but I can. So I talk about religion, I talk about God, and I talk about... That's what I have to, and disease, because that's above me, you know, I can punch up, you know. I can make jokes about Judaism because I've got some... My full name is Aaron Moses Abraham Levine, you know, which is... My parents were optimistic people. You wouldn't give your kid a name like that if you thought there was going to be another Holocaust. Now, I can make that joke because I'm Jewish, and, you know, it's on the edge. But, I mean, a non-Jewish person couldn't make that joke in the current environment. It's just standard.
Is there anything that you are looking forward to in these next few months that you can... add as a teaser of where we might find you?
Well, it depends. If the vaccine has had an effect on society, then my life will have changed. If it hasn't, it won't have. I will hopefully, ADD dependent, have written a bit more of my children's book, and I can tell you, talk a bit about that. I've started plotting it out on a whiteboard, which is a good sign that I might actually follow through on it. Or maybe I'll be a famous voice actor. Literally, I don't think so, but... I was an evil villain for a feature film cartoon that it never got animated. They ran out of money, but I did the voice recording for it, and I'm a pretty good. I can do a good. I do a good. You know, I'll get you next time, Gadget. I can do all that malarkey. So,
Aaron, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your story and how you guys have stayed sane. This was episode 1 of our third season with Aaron Levine from London. Stay tuned for the following episode of Record of Change when we'll hear again from Dedim, a multiple award-winning journalist, documentary filmmaker, and multimedia producer based in Istanbul, who will update us on her life and career and how it's been shaping up through the spikes in the last few months of 2020. If you like this episode, or Record of Change in general, we would love to hear your feedback, and even more so if you'd like to share it with your networks. Follow us on your favorite podcast provider or on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, or our website Record of Change. If you like supporting independent podcasts, we would be honored for you to support our efforts to bring you unique stories from across the world through being a Patreon supporter. For those supporting us on Patreon, you'll have unique opportunities and access, getting early access to episodes, bonus behind-the-scenes insights from the Record of Change team, and the opportunity to pitch questions for our interviewees, alongside us helping us make the show. Even the smallest level of support can be a great boost as we strive to document the impact of COVID-19 on communities throughout the world. This podcast is implemented with and by the members of the Bosch Alumni Network, a community that brings together former and current fellows, grantees, and staff members of the Robert Bosch Stiftung and his partners. Thank you for listening.